among the many, many things that I regretted after your death was that I never told you
that you loved me. Knowing that you loved me forms a small but statistically significant part of my memories. I hope that brings you some comfort, sir.
It does. Thank you, Data.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, dying to reboot Subspace Transmissions.
And we're here this week to talk about Picard Season 1. Did the return of Jean-Luc deliver?
I think that's worthy of debates. We'll get into it because I think where we left off with Star Trek Nemesis, everyone is kind of begging for some sort of resolution to what could be the most beloved character in all of Star Trek, Cam. So I think you and I, we had some mixed emotions going into Star Trek Picard. We had some mixed emotions watching it in real time over the last couple of weeks. We've had some breathing room now. And I think in reflection, we might have some mixed emotions as well.
I think it's fair to say, though, however mixed emotions they may be, people didn't have mixed emotions about the ending of Nemesis. I think they had very specific, strong emotions.
Not Geordi LaForge when he watched Data jump to his death.
Android Geordi LaForge, yeah.
But why don't we kick it off with this? Because I think this is worthy of conversation here with regards to modern Trek. And I guess we're talking about kind of the Kurtzman era, or Star Trek Universe, as CBS likes to call it, which no one else refers to it as. But we discussed Discovery Season 1 when it wrapped, and I think we felt as if it was a little all over the place. There were some standout episodes. There were some storylines that had us scratching our heads. There were characters that we loved, other characters that you could tell they just never had their pulse on in the writing room.
Yeah, Saru and Ash Tyler, really, specifically in Season 1, yeah.
Yeah, even though I think ultimately, like, Saru is a character we wanted to like way more than we did in Season 1. I think they kind of figured things out by Season 2. And I wonder if the speed at which they are trying to deliver storytelling in the serialized formats is well-suited to what we love about Star Trek. And maybe that's a leading question, but I also wonder if it's good that they're trying to push Star Trek out of its comfort zone, as opposed to just giving us kind of these throwbacks to the way television used to be. What's your overall thought on the way that modern Star Trek is different from what we grew up with, Cam?
Well, it's a really tough question to answer, because I feel like when we talk about Season 1 Discovery, when we talk about Season 1 Picard, there's a lot of frustrations mixed into the season. And so then the question becomes, am I being critical of the format or critical of the quality of their take on the format?
Sure.
Right? Like, if I saw the equivalent of, like, I don't know, Season 6 DS9 in the current format, maybe I would be like, this is everything Star Trek needed and I'm in love with it. But the fact is that I think even in, you know, Star Trek Discovery Season 2 is my favorite of the new seasons of Star Trek we've gotten. Even that one was bumpy. And I do remember there was a couple points in that season where even off the air, I was talking to you being like, I don't know if this show is, on a good track right now. So I feel like I'm still waiting for that ultra confident, well-told encompassing of what the Kurtzman era promises. So, yeah, that's kind of where I stand on this, I suppose.
Well, one of the things I've been asking myself, though, is if you take the word Star Trek out of the title of, Discovering Picard, and, you know, you wipe out the words Klingons, you know what I'm getting at.
Right, yeah.
is this going to be a series that I'm dying to tune into week to week with regards to both Discovery and Picard? And for me, that comes down to how invested I am in the characters and how invested I am in the stories that are being told. And I think what you and I kind of agree on is that these writers' rooms, they haven't really dialed in on compelling stories, though. I think what we've been drawn to more are the characters, or at least the character moments. And I think you struggled more with the characters in Star Trek Picard Season 1 than you did with Discovery Season 1. Is that accurate?
That's very accurate, yeah.
Yeah.
So it was like, to me, even when I was frustrated by, especially Ash Tyler, in Season 1 Discovery, there was a real excitement I had about the characters in Star Trek Discovery. Like, I was genuinely involved in them, and I was excited to see what they were going to do. They felt like they really just grabbed me, even if they weren't 100% nailed down. Even Saru, who was obviously frustrating in Season 1, you even had like the bickering sibling thing going on with him and Burnham early on that I found really interesting. And they had a byplay that was really strong, even in like episodes, you know, 3, for example.
I wonder if a little bit of this is these producers or CBS putting the cart before the horse, in that they are putting the idea of creating a Star Trek show first, and then they see what story there is to tell or what characters there are to discover afterwards. And I think most TV shows, what happens is they come up with compelling characters and compelling stories first, and then they go in and they pitch that to the executives, blah, 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 they get the nod. And I think what we figured out with Season 1 of Discovery, it was very bumpy. They got rid of the co-creator who had the entire season mapped out. You go with Star Trek Picard, and I think you brought it up on the show before, but the initial pitch that they gave to Patrick Stewart, the creators of the show, they eventually kind of tossed that and did something else. So
the pitch that excited him so much that he had to return.
Yeah. And I think by the time we got to the end of the season, we're like, this is what was potentially exciting Patrick Stewart so much. Like, this was the story. I mean, there are elements of it that I could see him being excited by.
Yeah.
I would say probably the refugee stuff and how that's so applicable to what's going on in the real world, especially he's a European dude. Europe's been hit hard by a refugee, a legitimate migrant crisis there. Mm-hmm. It's not something that we necessarily have to deal with in Canada, because our only neighbor is, you know, the richest country in the world. So I can understand why he's drawn into kind of the complexities of that issue. But beyond that, I'm just wondering, like, you know, what it was about this that seemed applicable to today's day and age. I don't know.
Well, I know, because you're kind of drawn in with all of this refugee sort of idea with the story, and you go, okay, Star Trek is commenting on something that is happening right now that's very important. But it's also, you know, obviously can be applied to other times in human history as well. But then you kind of get to what the crux of the actual season is of this whole android story, and I go, wait, like, what is sort of the grand message here? I'm a little muddy on exactly what the thrust of this entire season really is.
Yeah. And I think that's why you and I, more than anything else, we've been excited by Star Trek Lower Decks, because it seems as if it's the opportunity to have fun within the Star Trek universe without making fun of it. And if I think Star Trek often works great if the stakes are kind of low. Think about an episode like Bada Bing, Bada Bang, where it's about, you know, maintaining Vic Fontaine's computer program and making sure that he gets to retain his holographic lounge. You know, those are pretty low stakes. That's a fun episode to watch. And I'm way more invested in those stakes than I am if I'm told the universe is going to end, all existence as we know it will cease. I'm just like, well, I know that's not going to happen. So then I start to check out, and it just feels as if, you know, I have to wade through these inevitable action sequences, which oftentimes kind of bore me.
It would also be nice, too, if they'd set up stakes where either alternative could happen and steer the direction for the show's future. Whereas, well, let's face it, if the show ends, the season ends with the destruction of humanity and whatever, the entire galaxy, everything encompassing everything, then we aren't getting a next season. Like, yeah. You know, as opposed to like, say there was like a war existing, like there was in DS9. Say if one side was winning, that could affect the trajectory of the next season. Like it would feel like it's dovetailing off of that storyline versus, well, we stopped the end of, you know, the world or the galaxy, whatever. So next season, I don't know, a new adventure. Like, well, that's just not that compelling to really jump off of.
The repercussions are less real if we know, you know, there's really no story left to tell.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, this kind of relates to what you were saying earlier, but I remember, you know, I've heard this from several screenwriters, but Quentin Tarantino talked about how I let my characters write the story. And to me, these modern Trek shows are not the characters writing the story at all.
No, I feel it's so clear, and it's the kind of writing that's irks me, though. It's, they have a story that they want to tell, and their goal is to get characters from A to B, regardless of whether the character's motivations make any sense. And I don't know, Ken, you just finished your Sopranos watch for the very first time.
Yeah.
Did it ever feel as if the story was guiding the characters, or was it very much a show where the characters' actions were guiding the story?
Oh, very much the latter. And you could definitely tell that when the characters had reached a specific endpoint that really worked, they would be gone, or the show would shift storylines or fade them into the background. Like, it knew how to organically weave its characters throughout, like 7 seasons, basically. And I mean, that's something that I think that some of these Star Trek shows are struggling to do, is to let the characters kind of guide where the story's going, which is something that happened a lot on the older shows. You know, you would see that on TNG, for example. There'd be very organic character writing where it felt like those characters were guiding you through the episode. Same with really any other Star Trek series, except for these new ones.
I think about an episode like Chain of Command Part 2, mm-hmm. where we have Jellicoe and Riker butting heads the entire time. It serves both those characters as well as the story, and it feels organic in a way. And essentially, I think they keep kind of forgetting one of those, you know, writing rules 101, but, you know, drama equals conflict. And it doesn't mean that people have to be punching each other in the face, but it simply means that one character might want something different than what another character wants. And I think you always have to ask yourself, well, what do these characters want? And I think that's helpful. I think ultimately, though, Star Trek Picard, no matter some of the issues that we have with how compelling those characters were versus the Discovery Season 1 characters, I think I always had a good idea about what the Picard characters wanted and how well they executed that.
Right.
It varies. So I think they did a good job there. And maybe we can use that as a segue to start kind of breaking down kind of the characters, what worked, what didn't work, and their ultimate journeys here and from there. But overall, Ken, let's start with Jean-Luc, though. And we find him in a very different spot than what we're used to seeing him at the starts. He's at the vineyard. He's got his Romulan helpers, who were remarkably two of the most compelling characters for the few short episodes that they were in. But
that's,
we understand,
so strange, huh?
It is. I think they've got to reappear like somehow in season 2. I don't know if the writers quite knew what kind of response they were going to be getting there. But you understand what Picard's motivation, though, is. It's like he feels as if he's just been living, but he's not had a reason to live for, you know, 13 years or so. And he finally has a mission again, which is to try to save the sister of a woman he was not able to save. And we also get other motivation from him. It's like they're the quote-unquote daughters. I'm not sure I really quite get the continued use of daughter in this situation, but you know, they're the daughters of Data. And so I get his motivation. I think that's actually kind of a very strong thing that they set up right from the get-go by, you know, the first 3 episodes, which I think is kind of a good thing that they did right off the bat there.
Yeah, like, I actually do think it's a pretty good setup too, because obviously Daj appears out of the blue to Picard at obviously a crucial time in his life, where he's been basically had to leave Starfleet because of this Mars attack and his role in the effort to help the Romulans. And so suddenly Dodge shows up out of the blue. It's basically introducing intrigue to pull him into a story, which is something that, if you're writing it really from a character-centric point of view, really works. It's the show gets bumpy from that point forward, but as an initial setup for a story for Picard, it's pretty good.
Yeah, and I wonder about his journey by the end, because like he was setting it up, you know, I think with three episodes to go, that's he would be meeting his own maker. And I think we also correctly guessed that he would quickly be revived through his consciousness being transferred into a synthetic being. And ultimately, so there's execution and there's concept. I get the concept. It makes sense to me.
Right.
He has reached the end of his road doing all that he can. It's just execution. I think the problem is if you're telegraphing something like that hard, it did not for a moment ring true at all, especially when the name of the series is Star Trek Picard and it's already been renewed for season two. Like, I don't think they're going to rename La Serena, you know, the USS Picard for season two, right?
Sure. And it also introduces a real problem that is something that plagues a lot of, I mean, pretty bad blockbusters these days, which is writing by coincidence, which is the sort of thing of like, let's set up a disease for Picard, but ultimately at the end, he'll succumb to the disease right when he meets a guy who has a body he can transfer himself into. Like, it's like, wow, that's convenient. Good thing he didn't, you know, die during absolute candor.
In all fairness, I think Star Trek has a long history of coincidences, you know.
Sure, but in individual episodes, but when you ask people to hang on a 10-episode story this, that's where it gets more frustrating.
I just wonder if we're examining the whole Coast Emotion storyline in Deep Space Nine in real time back in the day, how frustrated we would be by some of the quinky dinks that were landing there.
Sure.
Yeah. So ultimately, look, I'm much happier where we leave Picard at the end of season one than when we left him at Star Trek Nemesis. But the question is, how is his journey from episode 1 through 10? I do get the real sense that this is a man that feels a sense of resolution and a sense of peace that he just did not have when we started off with him. I think they were successful in making that journey be believable for on my part, at least.
I agree. And I think they did a good job in resolving issues to do with Locutus, touching on his friendships, obviously with Riker and Troy. We'll get to that a little later, but touching on that and kind of showing through them how his relationship to probably the entire TNG crew has evolved, and that they kind of have gone in some ways their separate ways. They have their own lives. And we can kind of draw that just from that one case. And that's cool. Like, I like that it shows how Picard's evolved in that time post-Nemesis. And you are right. Like, when we get to the end of the season one, we have a good sense as to where this character is going. And it feels pretty earned in terms of the emotional journey. not so much maybe the physical body journey, but the emotional journey of Picard, I understand completely, yeah.
Well, why don't we jump over to the character who I think we could make an argument she is the number two of the show, Raffi.
I thought you were going to say Rizzo.
I can only wish. But unfortunately, she wasn't even the number two villain. She was like the number three villain or something.
But number one in my heart.
Yeah. Raffi is a character. There were some moments that didn't work for me, like her confronting her son on Stardust City, or else her ability to kick the habits after, you know, just self-isolating. That was a quarantine before it really became popular.
No kidding.
But those are things that didn't necessarily ring true. But I like seeing her relationship with Picard and how different it was versus his relationships with the TNG crew. Like, I thought that was a compelling thing to watch. This is a character who, when she was on screen, she had actually a lot of chemistry with pretty much anyone she was going up against. And this is a character, I don't know, who'd you compare her to in other Star Trek series? I like it when Star Trek series are introducing us to kind of unique and original personalities. And this is somebody that I'm really looking forward to seeing where her journey takes her in season two, because I think it's very clear. It's a parallel to Picard, but like she was very lost at the start of the season as well.
Yeah, I don't know that there's anyone I can compare her to. The one quality, though, that does, that sort of stands out to me, though, is that it reminds me a little bit of Beverly Crusher in her ability to call Picard out. This is someone who had a professional relationship with him, but also uses her personal relationship to be able to call him out on things that maybe no one else would. And that's something Beverly was always really good for on Next Generation as well. And I like seeing that quality in another character who feels very otherwise, very different than Beverly.
And I think you and I were disheartened that we did not get to see Beverly this season, but I think thematically and just storytelling-wise, it probably didn't make sense to bring her back if we're trying to establish a character that might have kind of an analogous relationship with Picard as well. And it would have reduced the importance of having Raffi in this season.
Well, if you introduce Beverly in an episode, the entire audience wants to just see Picard go off and hang out with her over Raffi and the rest of the crew.
Yeah. Well, was Raffi the most competent person, you know, showcased through this? Or could we make an argument that it is, you know, there's a couple other characters, but what's your takeaway? Because I love it when Star Trek characters get to show their competence or show how smart they are. That's always one of the intriguing things for me.
She's definitely near the top. I'd say it's a kind of a battle between her and Rios, probably. It is interesting, though, that Raffi is like a Starfleet character. You know, Rios has a Starfleet background, and they're the ones who jump to mind immediately as being the most competent. When we tune into Star Trek to see super competent people, and this is a show that is people who aren't in Starfleet.
Yeah. Michael Chabon, he's brought up before how he wanted to tell a story about those that fall through the cracks of the Federation.
And, right.
I think maybe we can segue into Rios as well, because this is a guy who's clearly, you know, suffering from PTSD that he doesn't really want to address as well. And, you know, you wonder why she's living in a trailer and Picard's living in a chateau. I mean, she's, again, kind of a victim of falling through the cracks within society.
Yeah, that's very true. One thing about the PTSD I wanted to mention, though, with Rios is, you remember that episode, I believe it was Lethe, of season one Discovery, where at that point we were convinced Lorca had PTSD?
Yes, yes. But he was evil. That's
he was evil. But in that moment, we didn't know that. Or even you could say Into the Forest We Go, where Ash Tyler has the PTSD breakdown, or we thought it was PTSD, that the Admiral talks him through. Both those examples of someone going through PTSD to me were much more compelling than really what they did with Rios. I really wanted a little more of that organic kind of bringing some like real world psychology into it. Whereas like the Rios character felt like a lot of the Picard characters felt a little too simple. They felt like kind of the edges were filed down, even though this is a show about people who exist outside of Starfleet and kind of like the ragtag squad crew. And I would have liked maybe a little more of that toughness we saw in Discovery with those characters. Because you mentioned it just a minute ago about, you know, Raffi basically giving up her substance addictions in like a single episode, you know, after isolating. And it's like, I would have liked to have seen maybe a little more reality brought into those situations.
Or at least like, it might be dismissive of how serious a condition addiction is, but there's got to be like a hypo spray out there that can help you out with that. But maybe she, I don't know. It was a weird thing for the writers to do. But Rios, if we're talking about him, I think he's probably the most charismatic of the new characters that were introduced in season one of Star Trek Picard amongst the main cast.
Yeah, I would argue that Raffi is probably the most compelling and probably the best written of the new characters, but I think that Rios is probably maybe the fan favorite. I think that might be the one that really grabbed people the most, because there is some flair to that character. You obviously have all the holograms of him. He has a little bit of that, you know, Wolverine / Han Solo swagger. He gets like to do like fun stuff on the ship, so I think that that character definitely popped for a lot of people for sure.
One of my favorite stuff we'd get to see in Firefly was when we got Dopey Malcolm Reynolds. Like, Dopey Malcolm Reynolds was really fun to watch. I hope we kind of get Dopey Rios in season two a little bit. You know, like, I think that's a character that we can have a lot more fun with than we did. And I think that's what they're kind of showing with some of the holographic characters that he got to play too. Mm-hmm. That to me, I think I like that sequence in Picard's office with all five characters more than you did. That worked for me. I hope they continue to have fun with him essentially having this holographic crew that remarkably looks identical to him.
I'm pretty sure they will. I would definitely like to see more of, as you said, the Mal Reynolds stuff. I would love to see a little more quirkiness and fun with that character going forward, because I do think Santiago Cabrera really nailed those moments where he was called on to do something kind of funny or sly. I would totally like to see more of that versus kind of the weird quasi-romance stuff you had with Agnes and him. Like, that to me was not his strength, putting him in those types of situations.
Well, why don't we talk about Agnes as well? Because this is a character introduced in episode one. I loved her. Episode one, I was like, oh yes, we haven't seen a character quite like this with her kind of goofy laugh. She was doing exposition in an interesting way, even though I have to admit I was a little bit lost with quantum twins or whatever they're
I mean, in Star Trek pseudoscience, I try not to get too involved in what's going on, because madness lies that way.
I ultimately think it was a disservice for her own motivation and her own journey to, I guess, essentially surround her romance with a much older, much older Bruce Maddox, as well as the fact that she was her agency was brought forth by a half Vulcan, half Romulan mind meld that was kind of given her horrific visions, which I don't know. It's like, this is a character that had so much potential, and I think they really kind of lost track of her earlier on in the season than I would have liked.
Well, when you look at Rios and Raffi, they feel like people who get pulled into the plot. Agnes feels like she is the plot in a lot of ways, which doesn't really help her out. Rios, the one moment to me where he really does get dragged into the plot is the stuff where we find out his traumatic backstory involves an android that looked just like Dodge and Soji, which feels really soap opera-like, and it doesn't really work for me at all. Whereas, like, that's just kind of that one moment. Agnes gets a lot of that stuff, obviously with all the Maddox stuff. It just, you know, obviously murdering him. And then, I don't know, I guess that's forgiven at the end of the episode because she had a mind meld. Like, it just feels very strange. It's very plot-driven material for a character that they're writing to be really quirky and kind of odd.
It just seems as if they lost, you know, a lot of that quirkiness as the season went on. I'm just like, well, like you said, it's more of a plot-driven character than anything else by the time we get to the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like to see what she does in another season, in season two, I guess, because hopefully season two isn't as plot focused in the direction that involves her so closely. So maybe you'll get to see more of her as a little bit of an outside commenter or a participant versus someone who's being dragged along like she is in season one.
I think there's got to be an opportunity. Well, we'll get to this towards the end, but I'll tease this. I think there's an opportunity in season two for her to get some interesting back and forth going between Soji. You know,
okay. Yeah.
Because I wonder what her role is going to have to be moving forward in the series, and if she's a cybernetic expert and Soji's if Soji's an android and we have an android expert on the ship, then I think they need to kind of mine that as much as they can.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure.
Yeah, so Kim, speaking of Soji, we meet her sister Dodge in episode one. I was like, oh, this is interesting. It's a character with kind of a compelling problem that needs to be resolved. And boom goes the dynamite, as they say.
And, boom goes the acid spit.
And ultimately, though, the problem I have with Soji, this is not a character that worked for me. I don't think it's the fault of the actress, because I liked Dodge when she was first introduced, but she was never really an active agent in anything that was going on until the very, very end of the season. It just seemed as if things kept happening to her and she didn't know what was going on. And a lot of this has to do with a lot of the problems we have with Narek from concept as a character. But I just ultimately Soji just did not work for me. And I liked the other characters that we've talked about so far, but Soji just, I don't really care if she comes back in season two. And that's not really something that I think, you know, writers want to hear.
Well, it's especially baffling when you consider, and I brought this up in an episode we did on Picard, but in case you didn't listen to that episode, when you look at the history of Star Trek outsider characters, you know, Data, Odo, Spock, Seven of Nine, T'Pol, those are like all the fan favorite characters, the ones at least that really grab you. They have a hook and there's something immensely likable about those characters. Soji does not have that. And I almost can't figure out why. Like, it's very difficult. This is the character in concept is the one we should be the most fascinated by. And I'm not at all. But like, you are right. Like, it's a very passive character. So that doesn't help.
Her hook, I guess, is thinking she had a life and then realizing she's only existed for 3 years and those are implanted memories. But it's just, it's not like we can say, oh yeah, we can all relate to that.
I wonder if there's a problem too, and that when you look at all those other outsider characters, there's something that makes them feel a little ostracized from everyone else. Soji has that built in, but we don't get to actually experience that on screen. There's never moments where that character feels ostracized from anyone. And so she's just kind of like, well, she's hanging out with Narek and whatever on the Borg cube. Everyone seems to treat her with respect there. And then she joins Picard and crew. They seem to like her pretty fine. There's never that struggle with that character. Hopefully we get that in season two. But so far, it feels like a character that's just kind of, again, it's the conception of the character is okay. It makes sense. But when they actually executed it as a mystery character, there wasn't a lot to really hold on to.
I wonder if the thing that everyone can relate to, though, is having a character or being a person in a somewhat toxic relationship. And I wonder if we can go to who is, I guess, supposed to be the main villain of the show, which was Narek.
He must be. I mean, I guess, and we've said this before, but I mean, his name's in the credits, so I guess so. He would have to be.
He was meant to be. That's what their intention was. And I think what happened, though, is we got more compelling antagonists who are giving more kind of pulpy material and less toxic material. Because, like, you can't love to hate Narek if he's just being that a-hole boyfriend that, you know, is just, like, horrible to this woman, playing with her emotions in order to, you know, trigger this android planetary search thing. I don't know. I was still very unclear about his motivations throughout this, but he just wasn't interesting as a villain to me at all. Like, I never cared about his motivations because guess what? They never actually spelled out his motivations. We never understood until the very end why he was doing what he was doing. And that's a real problem if that is your antagonist. Like, the best antagonist is, you know, exactly why they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah, well, exactly. And when you look at Narek, we see him playing this sort of weird, creepy, toxic boyfriend stuff with Soji. And we go, okay, well, obviously this dude's a villain. And then we cut to a scene with Rizzo. And Rizzo is obviously the more dominant character between the two of them. Like, he is basically cowering at Rizzo's feet. So then we go, okay, well, wait a second. This guy isn't even the main villain in his own little villain story. And the character he's manipulating is the most seemingly naive and vulnerable character on the show. Well, what does that mean? We are not seeing him manipulate Picard, in which case we would say, oh, like, this guy is a very smart character. We're seeing him manipulate the character who's kind of the, you know, the doe in the crosshairs.
Yeah, look, I think the most compelling argument that the writers didn't know what to do is they didn't actually give this guy an end to his story in season one finale. Like, I think they came out and said, like, oh yeah, that kind of ended up on the cutting room floor. Maybe it's like a deleted scene in the Blu-rays or something like that.
There's also that episode, was it maybe the first part of the finale? I can't remember, where he's not even in the episode, basically. They just show his ship. They show him silently, but...
I think that might have been Broken Pieces.
Might have been. He basically has no dialogue and is just shown in his ship, like, playing with this puzzle thing. And you're like, if this is a main villain who has your, you know, has his name in the main credits, I feel like they would write him something to say if they were that confident in that character.
They did give him one line in that episode. It was, get my shuttle.
Gold.
I know. I like, I don't need resolution to this character. I can't imagine me caring about him. You know, my fear is that they want to make him kind of the reluctant ally going into season two. This is just not an antagonist that worked at all. I was far more intrigued by like all the other antagonists, like even Android sister of Soji. I'm blanking on the gold-plated woman's name.
Oh, Sutra. Also played
Sutra. Yeah, like. Yeah. I found her in those, you know, 1.5 episodes infinitely more compelling than I did Narek. I found Commodore O and Rizzo far more compelling than I ever found Narek. And
yeah.
I think the thing is, like, it's tough if you put your antagonist in the main cast because you have to figure out something to do with them every week. And maybe it's, you know, you want the audience wanting more. And that's what we got with characters like O and Rizzo and Sutra.
Hmm. I mean, wouldn't it have been something else if Narek had secretly, I don't know, been amassing power within this Borg cube, and he was the one leading the chase and taking control of the Borg cube? Like, you'd be like, okay, this character definitely had a plan, and we can understand maybe how he got there versus what he does here, where he just kind of like feels like, I don't know, again, kind of a wandering through this plot, but not actually driving it, which as a villain doesn't work.
Well, okay, maybe I'll jump backwards to our topic at the start of this episode, which was like storytelling in modern Star Trek. And I think every single season we've seen so far, there's some sort of mystery. Like, we don't exactly know what so-and-so wants or what the end game is. I think that is incredibly hard writing to pull off. We see it successfully done very rarely on television. Mm-hmm. You better have a good plan if you want to do that. Otherwise, you don't know what people's motivations are. You don't know what the antagonist's motivations are. With Lorca, you really didn't really understand what the guy wanted until you realized that he wanted something really uninteresting, which was to rule as the Terran Emperor.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, oh, so he's just like a one-dimensional villain, you know? So I think Star Trek, you got to stop doing these mystery shows, you know? Like, I know that's kind of the modern thing in some corners of television writing where that's how you get people, if they're binging, to jump forward to the next episode. It doesn't serve storytelling very well. I can think of just very few shows that did it well. I'll point to Lost as one of the few examples, although people's mileage vary when it comes to that final season.
Yeah, and I know Star Trek fans are going to be in for the long haul with a show like Picard. And so, like, this isn't directed at anyone who listen to this podcast, really, who watched Picard. But, like, I think of people I work with, and I can think of three people who are fans of TNG and jumped, you know, to watch Picard because they love TNG. They haven't watched any of their series since. And of the three, only one made it to the end of Picard, and that person said, I'm not watching season two.
Yeah.
And so it's like, if you're telling a mystery and you're just trying to keep viewers going episode to episode, in theory, this model should be successful to grab viewers who are casual people because they want to see what's going to happen being dragged episode to episode. And at least, and this is anecdotal, of course, but in the three people I met, that didn't work on those three at all.
It's just something they got to fix. And I don't know how self-aware they are of that. And it's,
I will add, though, those three people, all of them really love Discovery. So make of that what you will. I don't know.
Wow. Okay. But the thing is, I think about some of the television-centric podcasts that I listen to. And I remember, you know, first couple episodes, a lot of Star Trek Picard talk. Not much Star Trek Picard talk as we got towards the end of the season, though. So yeah,
I noticed that as well in message boards I read that would cover Star Trek stuff. And I noticed the number of messages going back and forth over the first, I'm going to say 4 episodes of Picard was like a lot. And then by the time you got to the end, it was like 3 people talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, we've brought it up before, but I don't think serialized storytelling necessarily suits Star Trek best. Like we've said it before, we don't think movies suit Star Trek best. It works best in, you know, the television format. I don't think serialized storytelling works best for Star Trek, but we have seen examples where they find that right balance. And I just point to, you know, Deep Space Nine, where you would have, you know, episodes that were self-contained, but you would have the Dominion War in the background or as like a B story or a C story. Mm-hmm. I think what you need to do, and I keep repeating myself, but have A stories that are self-contained, and then your B story could be involving an ongoing serialized storytelling or storyline. And then from there, you might have, you know, one or two quote-unquote mythology episodes a season, you know, maybe the premiere, a middle episode, and the finale. And I think that's, to me, it seems so simple, but I don't know. I'm not in those writers' rooms where they're coming up with these ideas.
Do you think that the impact of Picard would have been different, maybe on some of these people that this didn't work for, if they had dropped the whole season at once?
Yes, because I am intrigued by how our response is going to be when we just binge watch it. We'll do our Blu-ray review whenever those Blu-rays are out. I suspect we probably won't pick apart so much of the stuff that we are right now. It would be much less frustrating to watch. I think CBS knows that all these series are really built, or supposed to be built for binge watching ultimately. It's just, we get a little frustrated when we have to watch it week to week and some of the things like this kind of grate on us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, Kim, we got to talk about one last character here. The sad sack of the series, Elnor.
Right.
He was never interesting. He was never put to good use unless you're just craving a little bit of slice and dice some action. But guess what? All is not lost. I don't think the actor is bad at all. I think what he needs is a foil. And I think they can figure that out pretty easily in season two. All he needs is kind of somebody to go back and forth with. He didn't really get that opportunity. I think the best potential foil for him could be Seven of Nine. They had a little back and forth in Broken Pieces.
Yeah.
I think if he's somebody who is a little bit with kind of that stunted growth or arrested development to a certain degree, Seven is probably somebody who's gone through a lot of growth over, you know, 15, 20 years, who can probably kind of guide him, push him in the right direction. I think it could be fun. But Cam, this is my least favorite character out of all the new ones introduced from Star Trek Picard.
Yeah. I actually think it could be maybe a little more interesting even to pair him off with Rios and have Rios be kind of the world-weary, experienced older brother type guiding this naive kid. I think you could get some fun stuff there as well.
Yeah, I just think they need to find somebody to get him to bounce off of other than Jean-Luc.
Yeah, I think you've got to... I mean, look, you're not going to lose the connection to Jean-Luc, but they've got to stop making that the central point of Elnor because it's not interesting. And we do not have the foundation of their relationship that is enough to drive this continuing forward, constantly having him make kind of starry eyes at Picard and be like, you know, Jean-Luc, you were my hero. It's like, okay, guys, like we don't have any of this footage. We're just going off the character telling us this without any of the relationship feeling earned. You know, we've introduced them. Now let's do something else with them.
Well, and as we noted, I think in 10 episodes, or I should say, I guess in 7 episodes, we saw Jean-Luc abandon Elnor 3 times.
That was the best.
Yeah. He needs to take a hint. He's just not into you.
The writers have to realize that, right? Like, how do you miss that?
Well, I think that's ultimately they're kind of giving him less and less to do.
Yeah.
And, we saw that with Narek as well. But we did see them giving certain characters more and more to do. I'm talking about Seven of Nine. I'm talking about Raffi. I'm talking about Rios. I think they kind of realized who they wanted to write for. And look, you can go with it, but the thing is, if you plan on having these people in the main cast in season two, you got to figure it out.
I agree. I am curious what Elnor's thing is. I mean, I guess he's kind of the muscle because he can fight really well, but I feel like Rios has a little more of that mercenary edge, as does obviously Seven of Nine now.
And Raffi,
and all three of them are more compelling than him. And they can all kind of do the same stuff, not with a sword necessarily, but if I need a fight scene, I feel like those three characters are more interesting being in a fight scene than Elnor at this point.
Whoa.
So they need to figure something else out that is his thing. I mean, he can still be a good fighter, but they need something else to be his thing.
I've got some ideas that we can get into in a few minutes with regards to what we want to see from season two. But why don't we talk about some highlights from Star Trek Picard season one. What's a highlight, a moment, or something that just worked for you throughout this series?
I think I have to say my number one go-to is going to be the Riker and Troi reunion.
A huge pizza fan. That's why.
Obviously, yes. It's actually disgusting, the pizzas I've eaten while in quarantine. Or not quarantine, but in isolation. But yeah, enough of that. But anyways, the Riker and Troi stuff. I think you and I maybe rolled our eyes a little bit about the prospect of shuffling in the old cast to be on Picard. And yet, the episode where they actually did that worked like gangbusters for me. This was the episode that I never knew I wanted. Frankly.
Yeah. Well, they're giving Troi fantastic material to work with, which Kate...
Some of her best in her career.
Yes. And it's like, and it reminds you about why you like the characters in the first place. And it felt real. Well, you're also acknowledging that life hasn't been the same for them either, you know? And I think they were helped quite a bit by the fact that they hired a very good child actor to play Kestra, their daughter. Mm-hmm. You know, like sometimes a child actor can make or break how compelling an hour of television can be. I thought this was fantastic. And I think the Riker stuff, it was fun to see him do the pizza stuff, but let's be honest, like most people were hooting and hollering where they're in their rural home and he's screaming shields up, sort of stuff. They're having fun with it. But it wasn't like fan service for the sake of it. It actually served a purpose here, which I think is the most important thing that you need to do when you bring back two such important characters, especially not just for the fans, but for Jean-Luc's life as well.
It added layers to those characters that I never knew I wanted, which is what you want with this sort of thing where you're going to bring characters back. It felt emotional. It was moving. And I mean, it also fueled the best episode of the season, I thought, and one that, I complained about it earlier, but like this was an episode that felt character driven as opposed to plot driven. Yeah. And, that's a great thing.
I'm going to go with what I thought personally was the best moment of the series. And I'll say that this is by a large margin. I love the Nepenthe stuff, but for me, it had to be Data's death.
Right.
That was the moment in, I guess, the 20, or I guess it's like, 35, 40 hours of modern Star Trek. This is the moment that really tugged on my heartstrings more than anything else that we've gotten in the Kurtzman era. I think, again, it's too bad that we keep pointing to, like, the return of, like, old characters from years ago. Uh-huh. But it felt as if we got some real definitive resolution in a really cool, compelling science fiction sort of setting. And I felt well served by what was going on. And even just the moments with like the music playing and watching Data wither into dust. Like, speaking of dust, the room was getting a little dusty as I watched that scene, Cam, as well. Like, I thought this was maybe one of the best send-offs in terms of mortality that a Star Trek character has ever gotten, period.
Well, I mean, second behind Tasha Yar.
Okay, well, maybe Jadzia Dax gets the nod as well.
Good call, good call. Actually, maybe Maddox.
Okay.
Okay. But yeah, no, I agree 100%.
Not Icheb?
Yeah. No, I definitely thought the Data moment was incredible and was in an episode that didn't deserve it. Like, I think this was so far and above, quality wise, the writing of that moment was so much better than anything else in that episode that it belonged in. And I thought it was just a really powerful moment for that character. And, ultimately, if this entire season gave us one thing that mattered, it was that.
Yeah, but you know what? When I'm going to anticipate this final episode so much every time I rewatch it, just because I want to see that moment again. So ultimately, what do I walk away with when I get to the end of season one finale? I have a good feeling, that's all I can say. Or else a feeling That's emotional. And I think that's really what you want to do when you're doing, you know, art like this, is you want to get something out of people. You don't want to leave them feeling just kind of vanilla.
Sure. Yeah.
Cam, any other, maybe another moment that you want to share?
Yeah, I'm good. I mean, I've got some returning character stuff I like, but you know what? Let's bring in something that's new to the mythology. I actually thought a lot of the Mars attack stuff was really effective. I thought showed the scenes of the android, you know, that was very much mistreated and ostracized from his coworkers, turning on them. I thought there was a horror to that whole sequence and to the entire idea of the Mars attack that was incredibly effective and is often like not at all existent in scenes like this, or you know, events like this, which just tended to show a big explosion or something, or a bunch of little ships flying around shooting beams. Like, it put a face on this whole event, like by showing this little isolated incident, and it made it feel like horrible and emotionally powerful, and it really did haunt you. And you, whenever people referred from that point forward to the Mars attack, those kind of images would go through my head. So I thought that was really effective.
And they did it all in 5 minutes. Like, yeah. That's why it can get kind of frustrating when like, you're like, okay, you've got like 10 episodes to do something like really compelling, but within 5 minutes, you can do something even more compelling. So I totally agree with you. I think this sequence was really well done and we got like some legit tension within this as well.
Yeah, it was way, way better than the Children of Mars little prologue of the Short Trek episode for sure.
You don't want to hear Peter Gabriel do another David Bowie cover?
I'm good.
You're good? Okay. It's everybody's doing that David Bowie song. For me, I got to go with Picard's return to the Borg cube. Mm-hmm. This worked for me. We have some resolution about his own journey as a recovering drone who... I don't know how many sessions with Counselor Troi he went to get over this. I think they did the episode Family and they figured, well, Picard's cured. We go with First Contact and you're like, yeah, all he had to do is kill the Borg Queen and he's cured. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's true. And I have to believe that maybe he's not quite cured just yet. But the thing is, we get him to journey back to the Borg cube. We get horrible flashbacks. And then eventually he says, you know what, I realize it now, the Borg are all just victims too. They're not the monsters. And I think that is actually what makes the Borg interesting, is how culpable are these individual drones for this collective consciousness, you know? And I wish they kind of played around with more of those kinds of interesting sci-fi ideas as well.
Yeah, I also really enjoyed that. And I did really like when they brought Hugh into the whole thing. I thought reuniting him and Picard was actually quite powerful too. I thought the Borg cube stuff was often a dead end, especially when it involved Narek and Soji, but when it involved Picard, it actually worked. So yeah. I can get behind that.
Maybe one last highlight for you before we jump over to the next topic.
I'm just going to do a really general one. I thought a lot of the world building was really fun and rewarding to see this season.
We talked about that with Barry Link on Absolute Candor.
Like the expansion of Romulan mythology and the different sects of, you know, how the Romulans exist in their lives, you know, with what Elnor's doing versus what Narek's doing. But also other things. I mean, there's the Borg cube with like the sign saying number of days since assimilation. All that stuff's really fun, setting up what the Borg are doing at this point in time. And even things like when we get to the first part of the finale, the introduction to the android planet with its flying flowers and all that. It was an alien world that felt new and exciting. And so like those sort of elements of Star Trek mythology to me were rewarding.
Yeah. Jumping off of that, maybe one of the other moments that I'll share those, Picard and Seven of Nine having their first encounter. Look, they both heard of each other and it was interesting to see them actually kind of connect over their own experiences being former parts of the collective there. It worked for me. I knew I wanted to see them go back and forth again. I can't wait to see what those two very compelling characters and very compelling actors might be able to do with each other in season two as well. This was just kind of that first taste that we got early on in the season.
Yeah, it was fun, the little moments I got. I definitely want more. Like, I was hoping there would be a little, just a little more on that first season where we get to see them actually have a little bit of an extended conversation. But you know what? Hopefully season two. But I did think they had chemistry together.
So, Cam, maybe just briefly talk about some of the bummers. I really, really wanted to see the Borg Queen. I thought that's what they were building up to when we went to the Impossible Box. That was right. Picard's return to the cube. I thought by the end of the season we would get that. I just think Alice Kriga needs to return just one last time as a Borg Queen, because she is just one of the most, like, top three iconic Star Trek villains of all time. And she did it in, what, like, let's be generous here, maybe 30, 40 minutes of screen time in all of Star Trek.
I would like to see that character as well, especially in a role that was maybe almost like humbled and having to not be a villain so much as someone who also needs help. And we could see that Picard, who has helped the Romulans, maybe is in a situation where the Borg Queen's coming to him for help. I think that could be really fascinating to see. So I'm down for seeing more of that character. As for a bummer for me, I mean, I think ultimately I'm really bothered a lot by the android plot that's going on by the end, where we have the building of an antenna that's going to create destruction and space tentacles coming out and all this sort of thing.
You love the Avengers, the first one.
Yeah, but you know, like, I look at that whole final episode and I think it's very telling that both Kurtzman and Akiva Goldsman wrote Transformers movies, because it feels like a Transformers movie. Mm. And that it's doing it badly and just kind of hammering those elements together in a way that just feels cheap. And to me, like, that was a real bummer.
I'll say this, though. I think our opinions differ on the finale. I'll repeat what I did say before, but I thought it was a very well-directed episode at the hands of Akiva Goldsman. Much better directed than any Transformers movie that I've seen, which, you know, Michael Bay does his thing, but I usually find his directing incoherent. With Goldsman's directing in it, like, there were some shots that just looked majestic, like nothing I've ever seen in Star Trek before. I was able to follow the action sequences. Again, I think listeners know I'm not so much into action sequences in Star Trek, but it worked for me. But I know what you're saying, like, kind of plot mechanic wise, it did feel like a Transformers movie. Like, I will agree with you there.
Yeah. So I'm hoping let's not do that again in season two, guys.
I agree. And like, we've talked about it before, but like, you can't every single season saying that the fate of all of existence rests on whether our ragtag crew is going to be able to accomplish its mission. It's like, no one's going to believe that they'll fail. And, you know, so then is the tension, well, what is the sacrifice going to be? Well, I don't know, Cam. What was the sacrifice this season? It was the death of Picard.
Although that was more circumstantial, really, because he just, he was ill already.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not like he gave his life for the mission. It's more like his illness just happened to catch him at the right time.
Yeah, and made Elnor cry. So, I don't know. Why don't we talk about this? Like, what we're looking forward to in season two. Like, what we want to see in season two. Let me kick it off, though, because I did allude to it just a second ago, though. But Seven of Nine. We really weren't sure what they were going to do with her, but it looks as if she's now a crew member aboard La Serena.
Yeah.
I cannot wait. I let's, you know, dot the I's, cross the T's. Let's get Jeri Ryan officially part of the main cast going into season two, because she worked. Like, she, like, every single time she was on screen, she was electrifying. We had a lot of issues with what she did in that initial episode, Stardust City Rag, in which she was committing first degree murder to avenge Icheb's very horrific and incredibly gory death.
Another bummer.
Like, we had a lot of issues about how she was reintroduced, but the problem is like, she's such a compelling character, played by such a charismatic actress. We're drawn to her, and I think the back and forth between her and Picard and the rest of the crew, it's going to be a lot of fun to watch going into the next season.
Yeah, totally. And I just want to learn more about who Seven is right now as a person. And, you know, when you have a plot-heavy first season and she only gets a few episodes, you don't have a lot of time for that. So please, let's just make some time and learn who Seven is now. Because we did get to learn who Raffi is, who, you know, Rios is. So there'll be plenty of time to learn more about Seven, and I'm looking forward to it.
What else are you looking forward to going forward in season two, Cam?
I'm just genuinely, it's really open-ended. I'm just genuinely interested to see where they go. I'm hoping that with the sort of this Android stuff kind of hopefully tied off a little bit, we can kind of go in a direction I can't predict. I want the next season to be something that I can't sit here and tell you exactly what I think it'll be next season, because, you know, you can easily say, well, it's going to be more of the Romulan stuff with O and Android stuff with Soji again. I'm hoping, though, that they're going to take a sharp turn where maybe those elements come into play, but I just cannot expect at all what it's going to be.
Yeah. Do you think we'll get appearances, I mean, from other familiar characters, you know, like LeVar Burton did that interview. He said it's pretty much a guarantee Geordi will be back, but
yeah. And we do know that Whoopi Goldberg was offered, you know, Patrick Stewart showed up on The View and invited her on season two. So
it looks like we'll be getting some more familiar faces. Look, just based on what we got with Seven, what we got with Data, what we got with Troy and Riker, they're batting 100 right now. I just wonder, like, how much does our nostalgia factor overtake, you know, the need for compelling new characters and a compelling new storyline?
I also wonder, you know, are they tempted to dip into the other series as well? You know, like the DS9s or the Voyager, you know, another Voyager character.
I think the one Voyager character that they would want to bring back if they could, it'd be Janeway.
Yeah.
Mulgrew has said that she'd be down for that.
Yeah.
I think that would be good to see Janeway and Seven go back and forth, because I think ultimately where we find Seven of Nine in season one of Picard, she's lost again. Like all these other characters, they're lost. And it generally made me feel sad thinking like Seven of Nine had this family for 4 years, but you get to Voyager returning to Earth and you realize everyone else is going their separate ways. They've been stuck on a ship with each other and no one else for 7 years. She had half that time with them. She's kind of a lost puppy dog. And maybe that's why she only had each of in her life. And so I think it'd be great to see Janeway realize maybe how she failed Seven to a certain degree if Seven's committing homicide.
I'm glad you brought up Icheb just now, because now I'm wondering, we had Hugh and Icheb come back in season one of Picard. Those are not characters that anyone would have thought would come back. They're very, in the scheme of things, small characters in Star Trek.
Icheb, how tall are they?
Actually, not that tall, I don't think, but Icheb obviously had more episodes than Hugh, but do you think we'll see some other like minor Star Trek characters show up in Picard?
And by minor, do you mean like non-main cast members?
Yeah, yeah. Recurring characters who, you know, obviously aren't main characters. Like big, you know, spotlight characters like Riker, Troy, Seven, that sort of
thing. Well, what about Sela and the potential for her to interact with Elnor or Narek? Because they were very vague on what exactly the constitution is of the Romulan Star Empire at this point. We know that their homeworld has been destroyed. You know, much of their infrastructure with it, and I'm sure their grip on that empire, it must be in a very different place right now. Maybe it's devolved into some petty kingdoms to a certain degree. And I wonder what Sela's role could be, and if they could actually fix this storyline that you and I both agreed really didn't, you know, come to fruition, you know, almost 30 years ago.
Now, I have a hard time believing Sela makes it out of this. Given how Icheb and Hugh ended up.
Yeah. So. Who would you like to see, like more of a minor character?
I'm trying to think. I would love, even if it was super brief, if there was just like, even like a photo, I don't care, of Rom as like the Nagus of Ferenginar. Yeah. That would be amazing. I would love that. That'd be so much fun.
Well, I think the most likely Deep Space Nine character to return to the series, other than Worf, would have to be Quark. So there could be even reference to Rom. Like,
yeah,
I'm intrigued by what Grand Nagus Rom has in store for, you know, the Ferengi Alliance at this point in, you know, the run of the century.
That would be really cool. Yeah. It would also be kind of fun just to throw in, like, if you could work it in a way that actually gave us something cool, but it could be a smaller element of the show, would be have like a Captain Ezri appearance or something. That would be fun.
I'm sure Patrick Stewart has been pushing hard for that in all his executive producer meetings.
That was the pitch that got him on board in the first place.
Yeah. He's like, but guys, we need Julian Bashir as well. Julian must be there.
What's Star Trek without a doctor? Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. That one's a real long shot, but I think it would be fun.
Okay. Well, Cam, I don't know. Why don't we have a little bit of fun here? One last thing. One last thing. I want to know what is up with the Klingons at this point of the 25th. I think when we restart the show, it must be in the 25th century. Because I would think 2399 when we left off here. But we saw the Klingons on Discovery. I wonder where they are right now. And I'm wondering if they reinvent their look for about the 47th time. But I'm okay with just maybe a few more details given to the classic look that we are most familiar with in Star Trek.
Michael Dorn's really excited about that idea too.
It'd be great if he insists, guys, I'm done with makeup. You're just going to have to film me as is.
I do think the Klingons are on the table. I wonder if maybe they hold off on that till season 3. I don't know. Like, I'm just very curious how many classic characters they want to work into a season.
We'll see.
Yeah.
As I was about to say, you know, why don't we have a little fun here? Why don't we rank our episodes from worst to first, if that works for you?
That works for me.
Do we want to go back and forth? Do you think just one person run down their entire list, the other person run down their entire list, and then maybe we can kind of discuss, you know, episodes as they spring out?
That would probably be less confusing for the listeners, yeah, if we just go individually.
Why don't you kick it off? Why don't you give me your list going from worst to first?
Okay, so at the worst, at number 10, I had Stardust City Rag. At number 9, Maps and Legends, which was the second episode. Number 8, Et in Arcadia Ego Part 2. Number 7, Absolute Candor, The Introduction to Elnor. Number 6, Et in Arcadia Ego Part 1, Alton Soong Intro. Number 5, Broken Pieces. Number 4, The End is the Beginning, which was the intro to Rios. Number 3, The Impossible Box, which was, of course, the return for Picard to the Borg Cube. Number 2, Remembrance, the premiere. And number 1, Nepenthe with Riker and Troi.
So mine, number 10, Stardust City Rag. Number 9, Maps and Legends. Number 8, Et in Arcadia Ego 1. Number 7, Absolute Candor. Number 6, The Impossible Box. Number 5, The End is the Beginning. Number 4, Broken Pieces. Number 3, Et in Arcadia Ego 2. Number 2, Remembrance, and number 1, Nepenthe. So some notable similarities, some notable divergences here. I think the biggest divergences we should address, though, would be Et in Arcadia Ego.
Yeah.
I thought part 1 was kind of frustrating, a lot of build-up.
World building, the weirdness, the alien worlds.
But you know what? I think there's a lot of that in part 2 as well. I think we get a great Picard moment in which he says, look, these are children. They have the possibility to learn. We can't just like murder them right now. Let us try to figure things out. And then of course we have the data sequence. Like I don't know how you can completely excise the data sequence from that episode, no matter some of the flaws it might have. I don't know. Like, for me, I have no issues whatsoever putting Et in Arcadia Ego Part 2 at number 3 on my list, which was significantly higher than what you have. And I think was number 6?
Number 8.
Number 8. Whoa. Okay. Where was Part 1 on your list?
I had it at number 6.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you had it even further below Part 1.
Honestly, if you take out that data sequence, it's in contention for the worst episode of the season for me.
Worse than Stardust City Rag?
It's in contention. I think I would still fall down on Stardust City Rag, but it would definitely be a debate in my head.
Okay. Yeah. We are completely, you and I, it's interesting. You and I are oftentimes, I'd say more often than not, in tune, but every once in a while, we are just totally feeling something completely different when it comes to that. So,
yeah.
Yeah, but otherwise, it is interesting. A lot of our stuff does align. We both agree Nepenthe, really good. And I think what gave the series a lot of momentum for us, or our willingness to stick with it, was Remembrance. It was a really good way to kick off the show, but it's Maps and Legends. We both had it pretty far down on our lists.
Yeah.
And Maps and Legends is not a very good follow-up episode to that. It got incredibly convoluted with the storyline. We didn't know what was going on. There's all this, you know, talk about Tal Shiar and Jat Vash, and it's like, huh? What?
I have little notes next to each one, and for that one, I just wrote exposition hour.
I know. It was brutal.
Yeah.
But I also think, like, if you're going to do a binge watch, we'll see an episode like that, and it'll just roll off our back. We won't even give it a second thought, and it won't bug us the way that it bugs us right now.
Yeah. No, totally, yeah. I mean, had you thrown O in there and some sunglasses, maybe I would have raised it up a little bit. But yeah, it's pretty bad.
A little bit.
But yeah, that Elnor one is the introduction to Elnor. I wonder if I would feel differently if Elnor had like really delivered later on in the show.
Well,
I wonder if Absolute Candor gets dragged down because of that.
Yeah, Absolute Candor was one at the time I was like, okay, this is okay. It's more world building. But when I reflect on it now, I'm like, I don't know, that one was not great.
Yeah.
And you and I were both very much put off by the violence in which they were simultaneously trying to abhor the violence of, you know, Elnor decapitating a Romulan's head, with also kind of glorifying the violence just in the way they shot it to make it look cool. It's just like, you can't have your cake and eat it too, guys.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's something that they are going to, I think, maybe struggle with, because we saw Seven Head moments like that too in the series.
Oh, God, yeah.
And obviously Elnor, as you said. And that raises an audience expectation for what they're going to get out of this show. And I doubt in season two those characters or other characters won't have moments doing the same sort of stuff.
Yeah. Well, let's hope for the best.
We'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Yeah. I have one final question for you, Tyler. You watched 10 episodes of Picard, rewatched them too, so you've seen the intro many times. Where do you stand now on the opening music for Picard?
It's grown on me.
Okay.
Yeah. I remember the first time I heard it, and I was just like, wait, what? Like, it was very much kind of the Discovery reaction, where I can finally hum the tune to the Discovery theme song, like,
Yeah.
But I have to say this, I don't want to pick on the composer Jeff Russo, but his style of scoring is not my style. It's not what I really particularly am gravitated towards. So I just don't think it's a good match for me.
Yeah. I think I would agree, like, the Picard score or theme song is better than the Discovery one, but both of them have that problem that it's more of a modern scoring problem, in that, it, you know, when you go back a decade or so, people who are scoring films or TV were trying to work in themes, like really big themes and whatever. And this feels more of that almost like generic, like Marvel template, where it's like, all these characters have themes in their movies, but you would never know the theme. There's no way you'd ever remember it. So it feels always kind of, I don't know, like it's wallpaper music in a way that the other Star Trek shows weren't. Like, when the opening music queued up for Voyager or TNG or whatever, like, it stopped the room. Whereas this stuff, you kind of go like, yeah, whatever. So I don't think that's going to change anytime soon, though.
Yeah.
Maybe the Lower Decks theme.
Okay.
So I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Yeah, Cam, we've been putting it off for a couple months, but it is time for us to celebrate Voyager's 25th anniversary. It's kind of a bummer year because of the pandemic. Well, yes, the pandemic makes it a bummer year, but we can't really celebrate it as much at like conventions, etc., as we all expected to. But I think you and I can at least celebrate it. We'll talk about what made Voyager, you know, what it is, some of our favorite episodes, the characters, and what its legacy is after 25 years. I even have an interesting story about like my premiere episode viewing that happened. I think I was, oh God, I'm dating myself, but I was 10 years old when it premiered and I was so excited to watch it.
Oh, that'll be interesting. Cool. Okay. So you can, of course, find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Visorless Geordi in season 2 Picard, Smith.
You can find me at Reporton, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Nepente Pizza for everyone, because we're in quarantine and it needs to be delivered.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.